So the topic of peace has been in my mind a lot these days. And I'm reminded that the flavor, one of the flavors of the Dharma, of Buddhist practice, is peace. And even sitting here today, it was wonderful to kind of tap in a little bit to the sense of peace that can come with practice, with settling on oneself. And it's really one of the, I find for myself, one of the great happinesses, great joys, great delights of life is the quality of refreshing peace that can kind of be in our hearts, be in our minds, be in our bodies, kind of just be something we taste and drink in. Today I was talking with Donald Rothberg, who is a friend and Vipassana teacher and very much involved in Buddhist Peace Fellowship and engaged Buddhist issues. And he was telling me about some of the anti-war protests he's been to in the last couple of weeks and in San Francisco. And the first one he was very impressed by was one of the big, large gatherings in Market Street and Civic Center in San Francisco. And a lot of the Buddhist community, Buddhist Peace Fellowship and the Buddhist San Francisco Zen Center and different Buddhist communities, they had about, he claimed, 300 to 400 people gathered, I guess, in the corner of Civic Center. And they had 300 or 400 people meditating. And they, he felt that they had a very strong statement to be meditating. And so it was actually hard to meditate. It was very interesting to meditate. I don't know if he said hard, but very interesting. Because he tried to stay very attentive to what was being spoken on stage. There were these short little speeches being given. And as the day got on, he said the people were more and more strident and aggressive and angry and violent in the kind of speeches they were kind of giving against the war. And it, you know, it was quite a practice for him to sit there and sit still and hold that in his awareness, something that was so painful as to hear people protesting a war. But he felt very confident that that had a big impact on the environment of the march, the protest in San Francisco. People would go by and notice these 300 or 400 people meditating. And he felt very strongly that it's a particular kind of message to be given when you protest in meditation, you know, publicly in a public place, and there's all these people protesting. And it's like, you know, you're taking your stand, you're sitting there peacefully, and you're not antagonistic, you're not angry with anybody. You're peaceful, but you very clearly say, this is where my position is. And then he was involved then, I guess it was last Friday, there were 85 kind of clergy-type people who were arrested blocking the federal building in San Francisco. And they're clergy of all kinds of backgrounds, you know, Christian and Jews and Buddhists and Hindus. And so at that point, he felt it was necessary to take the next step, you know, not just simply protest, you know, by meditating during a large protest, but actually do an act of civil disobedience. And from our kind of teacher community, he was joined by Jack Kornfield and Sylvia Borstein. And he described their nonviolent act of civil disobedience. And he said that they would tell the police what they were going to do, and the police would tell them what they were going to do. And they said, okay, then we'll do this. No, you shouldn't do that. You have to do this then. Okay. And they kind of talked, and the whole thing choreographed ahead of time. And when it was time to actually do the act of civil disobedience, they followed the instructions. there were instructions given both by the people organizing the act of civil disobedience, and there was a handout about how to show the proper respect to everyone, to the police, and there was instructions from the police what you had to do, and so they all did it very, you know, and then the police would arrest them, And which meant part of men is putting handcuffs around, you know, and putting their hands behind their back and handcuffed. And Donald showed me his handcuffs. He was very proud of them. He had put them in his pocket. And, you know, and they're very, very loose, you know. They're kind of cloth. They're kind of like, I don't know what to describe them, but they're kind of like, I've seen plastic ones. They tighten the plastic around your wrist and they hold you in. But these are made out of more cloth, I guess, maybe so they don't hurt you so much. But they're supposed to tighten up, I guess, and they can hold you really, and you can't move your hands so much. But what they did, what the police did for this protest, was they just kind of loosely hung them around the people's arms. You know, the loops were this big, right? And so they all, so he told me that he said they were all marched into the federal building to some place there, and they were standing there, and they had to give their names, no one was charged, but they had to sign a document that they were not going to sue the San Francisco Police Department for how they handled the event. get arrested at your own risk kind of document. And then they were all standing there with their hands behind their backs, and someone finally asked, you know, be okay if you took these off, these handcuffs off? And the response was, I guess it's okay, you're not going to hurt us. So then they were all let go. It was beautiful. I think it was beautiful, you know. Probably wasn't nearly as expensive as the people running around Market Street, as we heard about before. And he said that one of the beautiful things I thought was some of the police officers actually volunteered, that they were very supportive of the protest and were kind of, you know, against the war. And it was a very warm kind of relationship between the police. And how difficult had it, some of the police volunteered, also how difficult it had been to have been seen as the representatives of the people perpetuating the war and have all this animosity directed towards them. They much preferred this, you know, this act of civil disobedience and the way it was done. And hopefully it has an impact in the wider world that people of the cloth, the clergy kind of people, are involved in these kinds of protests. That was today. And some of this today will just be my own reflections on it, because I feel it's safer for me to just give my own reflections rather than give you some Buddhist point of view of this. On Saturday, I ran into an old friend who has been a Dharma student for many, many years, very, very dedicated practitioner, and has his own sitting group and is kind of a teacher a little bit in his own right. And he had used to be involved in politics. He was a politician, like into office and stuff, and recently retired from that. And I said, oh, this probably inspires you to get back into politics, I thought, you know, get involved with political work in terms of protesting the war. And his response he's not categorically against the war. He's unsure about his position about the war. He's unsure about the wisdom of the war and not war. And, you know, he's kind of, you know, he's unsure. He's given it a lot of thought. He's researched a lot. And he was on, you know, he kind of, not for, not particularly against it, but not, you know, doesn't quite know. But he wasn't, you know, going to fight it. He's unsure whether the damage caused by the war is going to be less or more than the damage of not going to war. So I didn't respond, I let it be. It wasn't the time to have a conversation with him. But what struck me about that was that I had assumed that he was, you know, against the war like I am. And I felt a little bit bad that I had kind of assumed who he was without, you know, somehow asking or checking in and kind of imposing my view on who he is and his, you know, his ideas. He was quite open to have a dialogue, and, you know, sometime hopefully we'll sit down and talk and have a long conversation about it. So kind of get that this from a different angle now. I don't know quite why, but my association since I was a child has been that religious centers, like churches, like I grew up partly in Europe, and churches in Europe were meant to be sanctuaries. And people could go there. And still, in this country, there was a whole issue about how much is a church a sanctuary. And you can go there and you can find sanctuary in a church in the old days. The police and the military wouldn't chase you into the church. You were safe as long as you were in the church. And you can stay there for years. And, you know, and you couldn't leave. If you left, maybe they'd behead you. But if you stayed there, you were safe. And I also had this idea that people of the cloth, so-called, people who are ministers or clergy or monks or priests, had lives dedicated towards being peaceful, being nonviolent. And when I grew up, I was surprised to find out that this wasn't automatic. And in fact, there were lots of people of the cloth, lots of clergy, both in Christianity for sure, but also in Buddhism for sure, who advocate war and been involved in fighting. And, I find it a little bit kind of a incongruous when I read last week in the paper about the U.S. chaplains who are there in Kuwait blessing the soldiers as they went across the border into Iraq. It just somehow it doesn't jive for me. It doesn't work. I'm so strongly conditioned to think of clergy as being people who are dedicated towards peace and not supporting war in any way. Maybe not protesting it, maybe being kind of a neutral space, like a church is a neutral space. A church is a place you find sanctuary and people are not for or against, but that's neutral. It's a safe place. It's outside of those kinds of games and that kind of conflict. And in Sri Lanka, there's Buddhist monks who've done the same thing. Blessed, the Sri Lankan soldiers as they go off to war. In Thailand, it's been the same thing. In Japan. So certainly in Christianity and Judaism and all the different religions, you find individual clergy who are dedicated to peace, and you find others who have other ideas about it. So as I became an adult, it was a surprise to me and a little bit of a shock, but I understood this. And then when I was practicing in San Francisco Zen Center in the early 80s, late 70s, one of the lessons I picked up from there is, again, the value of a spiritual center, meditation center, remaining neutral in these kinds of conflicts. Because everyone in a conflict, in theory at least, should feel welcome to come to the place where people can be engaged in spiritual practice that helps them resolve the inner tensions, conflicts, and sufferings that they carry with them. And so if you're involved in the political position, then the center is not a place that feels safe for people to come who fit to one side or the other side of the political position. So a few months ago, there was someone put up a sign on their window here that said, no war in Iraq. So I promptly took it down for that reason. I didn't want our center to be identified that way so that people who even are for the war, so George Bush, if he walked down the street, he wouldn't feel welcome to come in here and meditate. I imagine that, in my mind at least, he could use some. So I'd be very happy, but, that's my opinion. So I took the sign off the window and I put it over there on the community table in the back where anybody can put a flyer if they wanted to. And I thought that was a good place because it wasn't associated with the center then, because I want that neutrality. And then I talked with Tara Brock, who's the Vipassana teacher in Washington, D.C. And she checks in with me periodically to ask. They want to get their own meditation center building like we have here. So they check in with us periodically. How do you do it and what you're doing there? So she called me and said, what are you doing about this war thing? And I told her about, I felt the center should be kind of a neutral place. And she was she asked a lot of questions about that because in Washington, D.C., it's quite hot, much more than it is in California. And it felt, for her, it felt really, really odd not to get involved. And my attitude was that it's okay for a Dharma teacher to be involved as a private person, but not for the center to do it. So, of course, now I've probably already gone across the boundary of my own policy by sitting in the Dharma seat in the center and saying, I'm against the war. And that's certainly the message that came across. So I don't want people to feel uncomfortable, so maybe I shouldn't even have said that. But what this is today, partly this talk is my own reflections and a little bit my own kind of grappling with this issue and sharing that with you. And I was very surprised. So then in the mid-80s, there was an incident at the San Francisco Zen Center when I was living there, of one of the abbots there, in a very unfortunate circumstance and very stupid, I would think, circumstance, ended up being arrested for carrying a gun into the projects, in the housing projects in San Francisco. And I guess, you know, these housing projects back then, probably still, most of them are mostly made of African Americans. And he is, he was, you know, shaved head, you know, white guy, very muscular, and, you know, with a gun. So he was arrested. And so there was a whole issue about guns and stuff, and the whole community was very, very, very upsetting for the community. There were a lot of community meetings. And I was really surprised that an abbot would have a gun. I was kind of shocked by the idea. But I was even also shocked that we had a meeting of all the priests at Zen Center. I was a priest there. And one of the priests spoke up and said that, he, you know, basically, he didn't say this, but basically kind of sounded like he was a member of the NRA and was defending his right to have a gun. And he goes target shooting, and you know, he has several guns. And what was wrong with that? And I was just kind of shocked. And in fact, in the four Mahayana Buddhist monks in China, there is a very clearly a rule that they're not allowed to have anything to do with weapons. And for Theravadan monks from Southeast Asia, there's a very clear rule they're not supposed to have anything to do with weapons. But what happened is as Buddhism came to Japan, a lot of those rules were dropped in favor of 10 simple rules that doesn't clearly specify no weapons. So that Japanese priests don't take that vow, no weapons. But still, so with all this is kind of you know, my kind of strong feeling, strong sentiment about that some people in society, it's really helpful that some people in society are known as people, known as places that are sanctuaries, that remain neutral, that remain, they're dedicated to peace no matter what. And that's kind of like their you know, what they're about, and they recognize people go there because of it. I was very impressed when I was a Zen priest. Before I was a Zen priest, I was a long-haired hippie. And, you know, I had hair down to here, and I had this long beard, and goatee, long goatee that went down. And wore the appropriate clothes. And I noticed that, like if I flew on an airplane, some people would talk to me, but some people wouldn't. I'd sit down. Some people sitting next to me in the seats, you know, it was just certain kind of people who looked like they were, I don't know what, businessmen. A certain kind. You know, you can probably imagine the kind of person maybe wouldn't talk back in those days with a long-haired hippie. Anyway, so certain people wouldn't talk to me. But what surprised me was when I was ordained as a priest, and I had a shaved head and wore a little bit simple robes, that it seemed like I was everybody's business. Everybody would talk to me. You know, at first I thought it was a little weird, a shaved head, and you know, that was kind of a weird thing to be walking around San Francisco with a shaved head. But what happened was that by being a priest, I was kind of outside, seemingly outside of the usual categories that people were for and against people for. And a priest or a monk was someone who everybody could kind of feel like they could be friends with. And I never had any sense that someone was avoiding talking to me. I had a sense that people wanted to talk to me. They would like stop me on bus stops and start to talk to me. And people would tell me their life stories and suffering, you know, sitting on the bus, you know, because you're available. They're kind of available in that kind of way when you're a priest. When you have that kind of, so some people are available. Some people are known as being kind of people of peace, people of who are maybe not going to be judgmental or available to talk, be a good ear, a good listener or something. I think it's really valuable. So my hope, you know, for our little center here is that somehow we are able to hold that kind of space here. And we have, you know, the anti-abortion protests across the street, here, right on our street. And, you know, a lot of people here have all kinds of opinions about abortion, pro and against and everything. But what would it mean to not, in this context, not to express our opinion, but But to hold everyone in our hearts, it's going to be neutral in some way. Is that appropriate? So I had this discussion with Tara Brach in Washington, D.C. And you know, she was struggling much more with what I was saying, my view, my opinion about, you know, the center should not be, you know, should be a neutral place. And what I suggested was, well, it's okay for you as an individual to go and do what you need to do, but make sure that, you know, the Dharma center is neutral in some way. Is this interesting you enough so far? My reflections? I hope so. So I'm going to change now, I think, the direction of the talk. So Donald Rothberg's just talked about being there, sitting in meditation at the demonstration, and hearing the strident, virulent, anti-war speeches being given, and holding that in his awareness, and that was a practice. It was hard to do, and to stay patient, stay open, not to be contracted, not to get caught in thoughts and ideas and criticism. Just kind of stay open in the midst of that. So what I would suggest is that the practice of peace is a practice that's not easy to do, and I think most people are committed to it into some degree. And the question is, to what degree are you committed to it? You might be committed to do it in your own family, maybe, maybe not. But, you know, not to get angry in your own family, but to somehow do the practice it takes to say what needs to be said without being an explosion of anger. Or maybe you're committed in other situations that way. Part of the commitment to being a peaceful person, to a person who does not succumb to aggression, to violence, to hostility. The commitment to avoiding that has a lot to do about knowing alternatives to aggression. People who don't know alternatives are much more easy to succumb to aggression because they feel that, you know, what else is there? There's a certain logic towards responding with violence, to acting violently. Part of the logic is, I'm defending myself, and I have a right to defend myself. Part of it, you know, is an eye for an eye kind of logic. And there's all kinds of logic that people have that are pretty good logic. But what if you know about alternatives? What if you have a better sense of the consequences of this? So, for example, I apologize for using a lot of child-raising examples these days. But, you know, I've noticed, you know, there's certain logic that I tell myself about, you know, the appropriateness of aggressive discipline sometimes. And the strongest aggressive discipline I've done with my son is I've yelled no at him in a voice that gets him to shake. But I don't know if that was, you know, I have a lot of doubts with the wisdom of when I've done that. And partly I know I was acting out of frustration when I did that. But there's certain logic that says, oh, I have to discipline him. And then, for example, it might be that he's just really hungry. And, you know, so what do? So you by all means possible, aggressive means, stop the kid from acting the way he's acting. Or do you get him, you feed him. And as soon as you feed him, then he's happy. He's really the sweetest kid in the block. And so there's a lot of examples where if you kind of tune into the child, you see there's a need that's there. And so rather than kind of putting down the strict discipline, you try to respond to the need that's there. So is this true in other situations also? Are there alternatives to violence? Are there alternatives to aggression and hostility? And I think there often are, but people need to learn about them and be trained in those. I was very impressed when I was, I'm Norwegian, last time I lived in Norway was, for any length of time, was now it's almost 25 years ago or more, almost 30 years ago. And I'd gone back there from living here in this country. And there was a very strong, in Norway there was, back then, I don't know if it's now, but back then there was mandatory military service for all young men. I think it was 1 year of service. And there was A lot of people who opted for the alternative to military service, and like 10% of the young men opted for they were conscientious objectors. And then you had to serve as an alternative to 1 year in military. You had to serve 2 years in civil service. Like you had to work in a hospital for 2 years or do something like that. But there was a certain percentage of people who didn't like that option either. They're against violence. They're against war. But they didn't want to serve. They didn't like the idea of doing civil service because they wanted to be able to defend the country. They felt that back then, and there was all these little Russia would do all these test probes into Norwegian defenses, that they would send the submarines in and pop up in some fjord, and Norway was always feeling that Russia was kind of testing its defenses, and so there was some feeling that there was some threat coming from Russia, so people were concerned about that threat, and so people felt some of the young men felt that they wanted to actually be able to defend the country. Just simply working in a hospital wasn't good enough. They wanted to defend the country. But they didn't want to do it through serving in the army. And what they petitioned to the government for was they wanted to have a training camp, like boot camp, to learn about civil disobedience. Civil disobedience has a very good track record in a lot of different places of being very, very successful. It worked even against the Nazis at certain times. There's a lot of success. I mean, there's probably places that didn't succeed, but there's a lot of wonderful success rate around acts of civil disobedience. And they felt, we need to get trained in those techniques. And so we want boot camp. And we want to serve in the alternative army so we can defend our country. One of the great which is a very cute little techniques of civil disobedience, when the army invades, you go and take all the street signs and you juggle them around. And so the army shows up with their maps. Now I guess they have GPS, so it doesn't work. But back then they had to show their maps, and suddenly they're looking for El Camino, and they're on Almeida de las Pulgas, and or whatever. So it slows them down. And in Czechoslovakia in 1968, the civil disobedience there was amazingly successful. It didn't win out in the end. But it only failed because the Russians had to pull their soldiers out and replace them with fresh recruits who hadn't had weren't influenced by the civil acts of disobedience. The disobedience in Prague was so loving. They put flowers, gave flowers to the people in the tanks. And these soldiers couldn't fight. And so they had to pull them all back to Russia and send fresh ones. And by that way, they could quell the rebellion. And it turns out that civil disobedience is an art form. I have a book at home. It's 3 volumes. One of the volumes is this big. And it's all about the techniques of civil disobedience. It's not just simply, it's very sophisticated art. It's well developed and thought out and lots of examples. American society itself has lots of examples of civil disobedience. The union movement, for the most part, was a form of civil disobedience, a nonviolent protest that had a big impact in this country. A person's dedication to peace or to nonviolence or to alternatives has a lot to do, I believe, in being educated about what the alternatives might be. It also has a lot to do with learning how to handle one's own aggression. And how to handle, even more, maybe more profoundly than one's own aggression, how to handle one's own pain. Because I don't know what percentage, but a good percentage of aggression has to do with pain. I've seen it sometimes when I've been louder to my son than I want to be. It wasn't so much that my son was the problem. The problem was that I was in pain. I was frustrated. And I wasn't really reacting against my own frustration within myself that caused me to act a certain way. There wasn't, that he was being, he was just him, but it was my unhealthy relationship to my own pain. So it caused me to act out, in a sense. And that's really one of the heart issues of Dharma practice, is learning how to come to terms and relate to our own aggression, our own violence, and how to relate in a healthy way to our own pain. And one of the very interesting teaching around this is to look at the 5 hindrances as strategies that we have to avoid our own pain. And this is not the definitive definition of the hindrances. But so, for example, the five hindrances, for those of you who don't know it, are the five things that hinder, traditionally said to be the five things that hinder our capacity to be concentrated, hinder our ability to get concentrated, because it keeps the mind scattered and distracted. But also, in the same way, it also keeps us a hindrance to keeping the heart, the mind, unified, calm, peaceful, settled on itself. So these are, the first is desire. The second is aversion. The third is usually called sloth and torpor, lethargy and resistance. The fourth is restlessness. And the fifth is doubt. So to think of these as strategies, and to think, you know, spend some time with yourself exploring the question, what are your common patterns? What's the common way that you, when wisdom isn't operating, when wisdom's not operating, what's your gut reaction to your pain, when you feel pain or frustration? Do you have, like, everybody probably has their own. Some people, it's the desire mode. They feel personal pain, and they think, well, I'll just go out and get ice cream. You know, fill it with a desire. Avoid it with a desire. Some people, is aversion. I lash out at something. You can lash out at other people, or the aggression can be turned inwards. Something, I must have done something wrong. I must be at fault. And it might not be your fault at all, but that's, some people feel pain, and so they have to look for fault, and so some people... So the whole thing of blame can often be an aggression that comes from it. It can often be misplaced and misunderstood and kind of a reaction to our own pain, even when we blame ourselves in the wrong ways. And then lethargy and resistance is a strategy to pain, to frustration. You know, just give up, hold back, get, you know, tired. And I've seen it myself, especially when I was a kid. I didn't see it when I was a kid, but now I look back and say, oh, that's what it was. You know, it really struck me how I could get so tired, in certain circumstances where my mother wanted to take me places, and then how amazingly fast I'd revive. So, you know, just basically it was resistance. I didn't want to go there. And there's agitation, restlessness, kind of get lost in our worry and agitation. It's a strategy people have, a response to their own frustration, their own pain. And then doubt, you know, rather than just filled with doubt and just frozen by doubt, hesitating by doubt, holding ourselves back by doubt. I think it's a valuable exercise to do, to spend some time thinking, what is your common, you know, your own personal, unique way of responding to pain? Do you have one? And not to think that you're wrong for having it, or bad, or that's embarrassing. But rather, it's just different people are wired and programmed different ways to respond different ways. And some people are desire type, some people are aversion type. And it's nothing, you know, it's not like wrong. It just how it is. And actually, it's said in Buddhism that there's a certain advantage for being the aversive type in practice. And it said that aversion, people who get angry and aversive easily, they tend to be much more motivated to abandon their unwholesome tendencies. They're not going to be patient with it. There's enough of that. They push it away. So there's a little bit of an advantage to being in the Dharma, to be an aversive character. So, in case you are and you're feeling a little bit bad about it, you can look at it in a good light. The disadvantage of being a desire person, desire type person, is that it's sometimes hard to see that desire is a hindrance, is a problem. And so you might hang out with desire for a long time. It's kind of pleasant, seductive, the thoughts of desire. So what's your common strategy? in situations of discomfort, of impatience. It's now 8:55. I have no idea, you know, if this talk has been interesting for you or helpful or engaging. But by 8:55, I imagine some of you might be getting a little bit impatient. Where's this going? And you know, sometimes guilt talks on beyond 9. It's going to happen today. And so there's a certain level of discomfort arises, you know. And if some of you are sitting on the floor, maybe your knees hurt right now. And so what's your response? You know, some of you get restless. There's that approach. Some of you are just getting, you know, you're tired, but you get lethargy sets in. Just, oh, I give up, you know. Some of you are starting thinking about, you know, fantasizing about something else. And tune me out by now. Thinking about something wonderful, desire. And some of you, you know, are thinking bad thoughts about me. When is he going to shut up? And some of you just are in doubt. You know, what's going on here? So what's your way? And I'd encourage you, really encourage you, especially because of the war in Iraq, to do a couple of things. One is to look at your mindfulness practice, as your awareness practice, as a tool to understand your own aggression and your own capacity to be at peace, and to explore the patterns that you have for responding to hostility, responding to pain, and see if you can think of alternatives that maybe are wiser and more effective and have, in the long term, might have much better consequences than the short-term gain from acts of hostility and aggression. And see, you know, and I apologize for this last one, but I'd really encourage you to see, to strengthen your commitment to being peaceful. Or strengthen your commitment to not being violent. See if you can, you know, I'm really confident all of you have some commitment to this. But can you up it? Can you strengthen it? Can you expand it? Can you expand the domain in which you apply it to? That's my wish. Did I make you uncomfortable? So there's 3 minutes left. Any comments or questions in 3 minutes? Maggie.
I was wondering if you heard that Sylvia Borstein and Joseph Goldstein and Anne Lamott were arrested in Washington.
No, I didn't hear that.
Gently. It's not
like same thing. Great.
Yeah.
Gently.
Apparently they went over a barrier or something, or decided that was what they needed.
Yeah, yeah. To me, it's a beautiful thing, you know, people to act peacefully like that in a friendly way. And you know, Donald now, he has his. So I joked at him, you know, you're saving so you can recycle it? You know, show up and say, oh, you don't have to bother, I bought my own. Save the city of San Francisco $10 it pays for its handcuffs. So please, if you get arrested, save the handcuffs so we can be used again. Yes, Doris.
Tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, there's a mass movement that's around the world of people sending love to President Bush and for 15 minutes. And the people around him, and the idea is to appeal to the small child within, or the young boy within President Bush, and empower his heart so that he can make more compassionate decisions, and the people around him also. So if enough people do that for 15 minutes, the idea is that it could have a strong effect.
Yeah. Pardon? Is that done?
Tomorrow morning from 8 to 8:15.
I just wanted to add to that that my understanding was to send love not only to Bush but also to Saddam Hussein and to anybody involved in the the violence.
I'll have the last word, if I may. I asked Donald. I saw Donald today, and I asked him, what was most inspiring to him these days about the anti-war movement, the anti-war activities? What was the most inspiring thing that's happening right now? And he said, the fact that it's a global movement. You know, it's all over the world. I mean, it might be a small percentage of people in the world, but it's all over the world. And what popped in my mind was that because of that, we could, for different reasons than the last two times, we could call this World War III. Because this is one of the first kind of wars of, you know, that at least it's really clear. There's this global consciousness or global awareness of it. Like the whole world, in some way, is kind of watching and participating, at least, you know. And so it's the whole world is involved, and perhaps it's a good thing that we all see it. It's like we're accountable to each other now in a way that we maybe weren't 100 years ago. Yeah. Mark?
The Tibetan people have always been an inspiration to me, particularly when I find myself, a few times I've found myself what I thought was going through a hard time, and I somehow pick up, if I remember one time, the People magazine, and there was this article about the Dalai Lama, and he was talking about, he's lost 6,000 monastery millions of people. He says, they've taken everything from me. Can I let them take my mind and my heart? And the other day I was at Carmel Beach and I'm walking along the beach and I see these beautiful robes and I get closer and there's about 5 Tibetan lamas at the beach. And so I went out there and started talking to one. As I was I saw them walking. There's a Rinpoche who came from India that they were taking to see the beach, and they were walking him up the hill. And at the top of the hill, there's a sand sculpture. This guy who does these sand paintings. And all the
Tibetan sand painting.
No,
these Western art. Yeah.
Beach pictures on the beach. And I see them, like, their eyes open up, and they're standing. I wish I had a camera because this beautiful picture of these lamas sitting around just watching this guy do work with the sand and, what they do with the mandalas and everything. So I went up and started watching him. It was just delightful. And in the middle of all of this, there's still delight.
So thank you very much. And if my personal reflections and point of view has caused anybody distress, I apologize very much. It's not the intention. Mm-hmm.